fundamentally, I see people as being quite lazy, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're going to do the thing, en masse, people are going to do the thing that's easiest, cheapest for them to do.
Least resistance.
Least resistance, right. And so this is the opportunity for design to make the best thing for them to do also the easiest thing to do.
Yo, sucker! You got a big mouth! Every day I'm hustling, every day I'm hustling, every day I'm hustling, every day I'm hustling.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 2 of the Mr. Baby Podcast. This week we sat down with a good friend of ours, Alex Duncan, and he told us some interesting stories about his many business endeavors here in China, and how some of them worked out and some of them not so much. He also got into a bit of his theory on design and how he thinks it can shape our lives and how the way people act. So I hope you guys enjoy, and here we go. We buy the whole thing. See, most of my niggas really
still deal cocaine. My roof back. All right, let's begin. We are here with Alex.
Hi.
And like we started before, Alex, can you give us a 60-second life story?
60-second life story, wow. So I was born and grew up in a little sleepy village in England, and then after university, where I went to basically Hogwarts in the north of England, I decided randomly to come to China, and that's where I've spent most of the last 10 years.
I don't think that was even 10 seconds.
Yeah,
that was definitely over 10 seconds.
What happened in between England and China?
I went to Australia for a year. And lived in Australia. I lived with Aborigines and did conservation work up in the north of Australia. That was quite an eye-opening experience, especially for somebody that barely left their village for 17 years in England. And I worked as a graphic designer in Cairns in a recording studio / Apple store, where we had like artists would fly in. The guy who, the proprietor of that recording studio, was a DJ who'd been very big in the 70s and released some albums, and he seemed like he'd lived quite a wild life, and I was just this young impressionable 18-year-old kid who wandered into his store one day and asked for a job, and he sort of, I guess, maybe took pity on me, and I did lots of design work for them. I helped them fix the Mac computers. He just had just incredible stories. I mean, the guy was barely even allowed to drink tea. Like, he'd been as high as you can go, I think, in his career as a DJ. And
so he like just, he was burnt out?
No, he just, I mean, he just had lived such a wild life. Like, he sort of barely had any recollection of about 10 years of his life, I think. And he now was living sort of in this quieter part of Australia in Cairns, and started this little recording studio. And we had a band called 10cc, who you may have heard of. They're pretty well known. They had a couple of big hits, and I had never heard them at all. And I was just on the phone to my dad, I think, while I was there, and I said, "Oh yeah, we've got this band in this week, 10cc. Like, they're remixing one of their hits for the club scene or something like this." And my dad was like, "Oh my god," he was very impressed by this.
Yeah, he's a big 10cc 70s, fan.
Well, 70s icons. So yeah, that was. I mean, that was like a
bar named 10cc.
Probably. I mean, they had some huge songs like "Dreadlock Holiday," which has like a very famous line, which is, "I don't like cricket. Oh no. I love it."
Yeah, I don't think that one made it to the US.
I'm sure.
I don't think the line about "I love cricket" made it to the US. Maybe they rewrote
really
it.
I'm sure if you heard this song, like, you recognize it.
I don't like baseball.
Dubbed over, yeah.
Yeah.
Skip Miley Cyrus to do it. It's
So that was my only, I guess that was my only sort of time outside of the UK before.
Didn't you spend time in Africa as well?
I studied zoology at university, and we went to South Africa for a couple of months, one summer, which was a lot of fun. Went diving with great white sharks, and had a few weeks of fun before the rest of the field trip showed up. And then we went and studied antelope and whatever random creatures on some protected reserve It was. It sounded glamorous, but when you spend several hours a day, like observing the head movements of a zebra, for your American audience, and then noting them down with some hope of understanding the zebra better, it was not what I'd hoped. We had to identify all of these different animals by their dung and remember all their Latin names as well. So we had this like. Test at the end of our field trip, like, what is this the droppings of? And you had to say, oh, that's like a kudu or a blesbok or a steenbok or whatever these things were. So that was, yeah, that was a fun trip though.
So what got you into zoology? You wanted to...
I mean, it's, I honestly, when I sort of, people ask me this quite often, like, it seems like a really random thing to study, and this is honestly the story. I had my school sent us all down to Cambridge for like an interview or some kind of open day thing, because they were trying to push quite a few of us to apply to Cambridge, and we were on the bus on the way down, and you kind of had to decide which departments you wanted to view and like which lecturers you wanted to speak to before they sort of divided us up. And I was sat there with the Cambridge University prospectus. And I'd just been reading Richard Dawkins' The Blind Watchmaker, which is a great book, if you ever get the chance to read it. And I was like, oh, I really don't know where I want to go. Like, I had sort of no kind of academic focus at all. And I just literally opened the prospectus from the back where all the courses were listed. And the first one I saw was zoology. And I said, I'll go to the zoology department. And Cambridge University has this incredible zoology museum where there are skeletons and like stuffed animals of things you never even knew existed. I mean, we all had picture books of animals as a kid. And you see these things. It was like this 5 meter tall, like giant ground sloth. Like, I never knew that thing existed, and they have one, like, standing there in the zoology museum. I was like, this is a really cool subject to study. And so, I guess I just, I can, after that day, I don't ever remember thinking, should I study something else? I was like, I'm going to be a zoologist.
And I just learned my lifelong goal. Yeah. My lifelong dream today.
How many sloths are there in the curriculum, I guess?
I mean, very, very few. I mean, it definitely is a course. It gives you an incredible appreciation for the beauty of kind of nature, and like what happens inside every single cell in your body is simply mind-blowing. And like just understanding how the retina of your eye processes the information it gets about the world and turns that into these rich pictures in your head, like it's just fascinating. I mean, we studied the retina for maybe... I want to say 2 or 3 months alone, just on that one part of animals, looking at how that possibly came to be and how it processes information. So it was a fascinating course, but very little kind of practical applications beyond just sort of studying it at university. Mm-hmm. I think out of my class of 30 zoologists, I think maybe 2 of them continued to stay in zoology, and most of them worked in zoology or biology departments teaching other zoologists.
That's about right. I was going to say, a lot of those like really specific academics seem like, what do you got to do with that? Teach that.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the only way to go with it.
Self-sustaining, yeah.
It's like, or just write papers on it for your...
But this, to be honest, this is a classic thing with university in the UK. It's literally sort of an opportunity to be in a place for 3-4 years without much... to do, like, just to kind of, I guess, a growing up learning experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So actually, most of what I did while I was at university was produced and directed and acted in plays and, you know, like, got involved in student politics and all sorts of stuff like that.
So. Can we go back a little bit further? I'm really curious to hear what you were like growing up. Like, did you have trouble fitting in at Hogwarts?
I was a total sort of nerd as a kid, I guess.
But you're like a very social nerd.
I don't know.
Maybe now.
Maybe now I seem like that, but I think like at school I had maybe 2 friends for my almost entire time at school. I really didn't gel or fit in. I have almost no friends from high school that I stay in contact with. All my friends that I'm in contact with are from university, which was the kind of the first time I think I was more popular than...
Like you were really involved on campus.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I guess the reason that my mother always pushed me to be quite social, I guess, even when I was young. She made me go to, you know, study drama and take drama exams and things like this, and sent me to debate class or public speaking things, and so I guess that was why I was reasonably confident, and probably in hindsight quite obnoxious and annoying, which is maybe why I didn't have that many friends. Like, I was generally quite bright, and I was not afraid of letting other people know, which doesn't endear you to people.
Like early, like middle high school, it's like it might be a negative, but then like later on in life, later you discover like, now I'm killing it because no one learned this because they were like,
yeah,
not afraid, but it's just like it wasn't cool to do that.
One of my earliest memories actually was like one of these very very young. I was probably first year at school, and nobody else in the class really knew how to read at that point, but my mother had sort of taught me to read even before I went to school. And we had this book, and there was only the word look on, like, every single page of, like, this 20-page book. And I just remember thinking, what the hell is this? Like, and I was already starting to read small, like, stories about, you know, yeah.
what kind of nerd were you?
Oh, I was quite a computer nerd, to be honest. Back in sort of the very late 80s or maybe early 90s, my parents bought an Apple Mac. Because my mother's a cartographer, and she wanted to shift from pen and ink drawing maps to...
My mom was also a cartographer.
Really? Yeah. Awesome. Where did your mom work?
She worked for the Navy for a little bit, and then became a housewife, and then went back for graphic design later.
Right. Yeah. So my mum sort of retrained, I think she saw kind of the writing was on the wall for pen and ink.
Yeah.
And very early on, we had an Apple Mac at home, and there were basically no games at all on this Apple Mac. And so the only kind of thing I could do on it was learn to use her design software. And so I'd start doing all my homework and things like this, and, you know, laying out all these presentations and all sorts of stuff, just obsessing about it and making stupid little animations. And, yeah. Frame by frame at the time, drawing them with graphic pen, and so that's the kind of nerd I was. Like, I just had this love of using the computer. Like, when I found out you could tell the computer to speak words, like, I would write, like, little stories and get the computer to read
them. Logo Writer, when that came out, did you ever use that?
No, it was...
The Turtle. Do you remember
that? Oh, yes. Yeah. That was DOS, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was, like what, not 7-inch. What's so a big floppy...
Yes, yeah, we only ever had a Mac at home. I've never personally owned a PC in my life. I've only ever had Macs through the good times and the bad times of Apple. When at school, like, my friends who also like computers, they were like, oh, you have a Mac, you're an idiot. I have a 486 or whatever it was. That's horrendously nerdy thing.
So you've always been in tech. I was going to ask you how you got from, because now you work in tech, and you went from zoology to end up in tech.
I always think of myself actually primarily as a designer. Yeah, I think like I'm very incredibly visual. Like, I really struggle, like, whenever I can only really consume things presented in quite a visual way. Like, I really struggle with long written things. And so I just taught myself to do design from a very young age, like just having this Apple Mac around, doing my homework, and eventually my father started his own business, and I was helping him, supporting him a lot with... He needed to do lots of maps and reports and things like that, and he didn't want to spend money on a designer, and he had his, like, 12 or 13-year-old son at home who could be used as some ready slave labour. And so, although he did pay me reasonably well, and so I just would do huge amounts of work for him. And you just, you know, over time, you just hone your skills and your, you know, visual understanding of how things fit together. I had a couple of internships... where I, you know, when I was 14 or something, I went to work in the design department of university and understood, like, more what it was like being a designer. And actually, the real time, I guess, that I really started to do it really properly was when I went to Australia and I got this job doing actual design work for sort of all these clients that came in, doing tour posters for bands that were travelling around Australia. And then I sort of started touching on the web at the time. There was one guy that came along and he needed a website, and I remember my boss said, oh, can you just build him a website? I was like, you know, I don't know anything about the web, like, it's all technical code and stuff like this. I'm just a visual guy. And so I started to use Dreamweaver, which was, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you ever used Dreamweaver, like, it's an absolute piece of crap. And
it was, when I learned Dreamweaver, it was like the program. And then, like, I didn't touch any of that for, like, years. And then it came back. It was like, no, nobody uses that anymore.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, the idea that you could sort of design a website without knowing how to write any code at all, is, in hindsight, a complete joke. And I very rapidly got so frustrated with Dreamweaver, and I would use Google just to find out, like, how do I solve this bloody problem that I'm having? And often it would say, open the code and, like, type in this, and you just get familiar with it.
Yeah.
And then once you've learned to write HTML, you go into JavaScript and server-side languages and stuff. And so I just became, like, understanding the code and the technology was just a way to get a better end result, which sort of really was my goal. Like, ultimately, the goal was to create something visually really quite cool. And obviously, the stuff that underlies it is really fundamental to it. So that's why I became kind of a programmer as well. And these days, actually, with sort of our company, and which, Sean, I know you're familiar with what we do, like you get to this point where, like, you really, like, you have to take your understanding to another level, like a very much a big picture, like how are we kind of solving things in the long term, in order to support, like, a fantastic experience for our users, which is being able to traverse all of, like, this spectrum of not just knowing how to write a single line of code, but then going up to a big picture and how do you manage 100,000 lines of code written by 5 or 10 different people over a period of years. Like, that's a very different problem. It's quite a human problem. Mm-hmm. It's an organization, a structural problem. And that's kind of a lot of where my interest is focused these days, is, like, how are we building a team that can do really great work? And so,
Let's get to some of these stories. The one I want to hear most about was, you said you were part of a Ponzi scheme.
I mean, I'm going to have to talk about this in incredibly general terms.
That's all right.
But yet, so, you know, being sort of generally in the startup ecosystem, you meet a lot of different people with very different kind of attitudes as to how you should build a business and solve certain problems. And we all know, like, especially in China, there's a huge amount of funding flowing around and companies being given millions and millions of dollars to build things. And I came across one individual who just had an incredible ability to get people to give him money.
Yeah.
And incredible lack of ability to actually spend that money effectively. And it was just a phenomenal experience, and it made me personally quite against raising money.
I've only been in startup world for a few years, but I've also met these people. Like, you meet them real quickly.
Where was this guy from?
He was from the US.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think it's, like, intrinsically an American thing. I'm sure people like this exist everywhere.
I guess there's a business thing, like, and they kind of see what's going on right now. Like, tech is so big, and they're just like,
I can
worm my way into that.
I mean, in this particular case, it was incredible seeing sort of very sort of smart and well-respected investors kind of get very excited about the things he was trying to do. And at the same time, just seeing the inside of it and just the chaos and the inability to actually stay focused and effectively do anything was just... it gave me a really bad feeling. Like, I felt like if I had been involved in that... I would have, like, been compromising myself morally or something. I felt like I would almost be part of a fraud to work with this guy. It was, and so I think now, like, my objective in running our company is that we stay as lean and effective as possible, that we don't raise too much money, and that we use resources we have, like, as effectively as we can. We'd be, smart rather than just... this scattergun approach of just spending money lavishly in order to acquire users. And I think, I see some people just believing in magic, like believing that, we can just try these techniques that I've read about on Medium or whatever it is, and, like, we'll generate 1,000 users and it'll all just work out. I do not believe in magic at all. And maybe this is the control freak side of me. I want to know exactly how this thing we're going to do is going to work.
Yeah.
Like, I don't just believe in pissing into the wind, and, you know.
There's also a big thing when, like, you get that big lump of money, and you're like, we need to look like we're a company. So you spend a bunch of it on, like, office and...
Right,
like,
yeah.
Physically looking like a successful company, and it's like, maybe you should be more stable when you, like, start this side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely a situation I've come across as well, like these... sort of lavish offices and no business model. But this is the classic thing in China at the moment. Like, all these, especially these bike sharing companies, it's just insane. Like, how does anybody come along and see that there are, you know, 6 or 8 already very well-funded bike sharing companies and go, do you know what I'm going to start? A bike sharing company.
Can you explain a little bit of that to people who are not here in China? What's going on right now with the bike share?
I guess so. For people from the West, like, the best example would be like the Bloomberg bikes in New York,
yeah,
or
the
Boris bikes in London. The only difference here being that those bikes are not provided by the government. They're provided by private companies. They're GPS enabled and they don't have docking stations. So they can be parked literally anywhere, which is fantastic. Like,
that was the big selling, like, why they were smart.
It is an awesome solution to the problem, but you only need one or maybe two of these companies in a city. And the problem is, in China, there is so much venture capital and so much investment money flowing around that's just being spent incredibly stupidly. And we have now 30 of these companies that all have their very subtly different take on the bike sharing problem. And 28 of them are going to fail.
Yeah. And not only that, but in the last year they've, like... it has to be 3 to 5 times the amount of bikes on the street.
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely
and
ruthless.
You walk down the street and the entire side of the street is wall-to-wall rideshare bikes.
But I don't know if you guys have been through the expo part of Shanghai recently.
No.
But it is insane. There are sections that are, you know, 2 or 3 kilometers long, and their bikes are just stacked up on both sides of the road.
I saw one city finally ban them because over the holiday, there's like a lake... I think it was Shenzhen. There's a lake, and it's got this maybe 3-meter-wide walkway, and two-thirds of it was all bikes. And they just said, this is it. These are no longer allowed in our city. We're banning these and, like, you know, hauled them all away.
Yeah, as somebody who's kind of really environmentally conscious and environmentally minded, I love the concept of bike sharing. I think it's a fantastic solution to, like, urban transport, short journeys. It's great to get people more active out on the bikes from that perspective. But then we've completely undermined that environmental objective by producing way too many bikes, littering the place.
China did it. Like, 17 companies and way too many bikes.
It's just insane. Yeah.
So what was the guy you were working for? Can you get into more specifics of what his scheme was?
He was trying to solve a very big problem, which was he was trying to help kind of American retailers in sort of small towns. I guess, I mean, the very noble objective, great problem to be solving. The big thing I would say is, to give you another example, like, I think mobile phone networks in the UK suck, right? I think they're essentially criminal organisations. But as much as I understand that problem and really feel it as a consumer, you wouldn't give me $10 million to start a mobile phone network because I am going to fail. And I would say that was very similar in this situation. As much as he had a passion for a problem, he had just no ability to execute. And just kept solving that inability to execute by raising and spending more money in very foolish ways.
So he wasn't like purposefully scamming people. It was just, he was like an overconfident.
I would say there were areas where he definitely stretched morality to a high degree. I mean,
he was trying, but he didn't care if he failed because it wasn't his money.
I guess he didn't look at it in the same way I looked at these situations, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You would see kind of PPT slides that just were being presented as kind of the progress of the company, and it just had absolutely no bearing on reality, and was actually even worse, I would say, is covering up something else. And so I try with what we do at work. Yeah. So, like, although you do have to tell a good story and you have to tell kind of the best version of what you're doing, it's none of it is factually inaccurate. No. You know, when we show a graph of usage, it's the actual graph of usage from our app. Yeah. It's not just some, you know, diagonal line shooting off the top right corner of the page.
Yeah. I think that's become just common practice, though, to be like, oh, these are our clients. It's like, oh, are they actually? It's like, no, but they could be. But they don't even know that. It's like, it's very, very muddy waters.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's these experiences that kind of guide you to have a better understanding of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you meet people who either inspire or kind of frighten you, as this person did, you kind of tighten and adjust your sense of who you are and who you want to be, which China definitely has a lot of people that can do that for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think also startups really rely on that core team. You need different people to fit different roles and also to balance out that workflow, I guess. Like, I mean, I've met a lot of people who run companies who are really good at this one thing, but they don't have someone to fill out, like, the business side or the human resources side, whatever that other factor is.
Absolutely, and you can never, like, no person ever can be good at everything, and you have to, I think, as an entrepreneur, you have to realize that and know and be okay with it as well. Just be like, okay, I cannot do this very well. I need to get somebody to help me do that because it's not in my nature. I don't have the time, whatever the reason is.
And also important just to for somebody to value those skills that they don't necessarily have.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
So you said you moved a warehouse.
Oh, that was a very interesting... that was a great experience of like how hoping and praying can go pretty badly wrong. I worked for an e-commerce company when I first came to Shanghai, and we had this little tiny warehouse that was based in a China Post office up north in the city, and it had grown kind of organically as the company had grown, and it was stacked floor to ceiling, and it had like six people in there who were constantly picking the products off the shelves and combining them. And so the plan was to allow the business to scale, was to take that warehouse, put it in a much bigger space, give it proper racks and organization, a computer system, rather than everything being based on sheets of paper that were printed out every day with the orders on. And so we decided to combine these two wildly ambitious projects of both moving and computerizing the warehouse in one project. We decided to do it at... I don't know if it was Chinese New Year or October holiday, but it was like done at a time that was wildly inappropriate. just because we'd kind of said, oh, this was the deadline, and no matter whether or not we were ready, we're going to move this warehouse.
Chinese workers,
obviously. It was Chinese workers. I barely spoke any Chinese at that point, and so there was definitely a communication gap. And... you know, when I set the scene like that, you're like, oh, this is going to go wildly wrong. And it did go wildly wrong. We basically packed up all the... We said, okay, we're going to move on this day. We're going to pack up everything today. We're going to move it. And then tomorrow, we're going to unpack it and we'll start shipping orders. Mm-hmm. We'll have like a backlog of a couple of days.
What kind of product was it?
It was many. It was like tiny things. The business was selling like accessories. So the cables that go with things, the needles for a tattoo gun, little trees for a model train set. Like it was 7,000 or 8,000 totally random different products. Like, and they were being shipped all over the world.
Just in, like the runoff from factories in China.
It wasn't so much that. It was like any time you buy a thing, you also need some other things to go with it. Like when you know, and it was the things that go with the main
the other
thing.
Things.
So we sold none of the main thing. We didn't sell a tattoo gun. We didn't sell, you know, an iPhone or any. But obviously, we didn't sell any of the main things. We sold like little cables and accessories and batteries and.
I'm missing two trees for my railroad.
Is it all in like wholesale?
It was kind of more wholesale prices, but it was the benefit was being in China, you could get these things so cheaply, and so you could. The high cost was the shipping, so we're shipping directly to an individual. So if you're sat in New York and you need a tuning hammer for your piano or whatever it is, you can order it from us, and we're going to ship that one thing through the regular post to you on the other side of the world. And so, so that moving this warehouse, we packed up all the products, moved them to the new location, and basically just sort of the racks hadn't arrived. Like, this was another crazy thing. Like, the warehouse wasn't even ready. Like, it was just basically an empty concrete shell, essentially. Laid all these things out on the floor because we had no racks for them to go on, and kind of got these new computers set up. And the computer system wasn't really working. It hadn't been tested. Sort of at all. Like, we'd not, I didn't think we'd even run through one single cycle of like shipping an order with the new computer system.
and we were suddenly expecting to ship
the entire company
2,000 orders a day or whatever, like some insane amount of orders every day. And the new system relied on the computer knowing where everything is, not the people knowing where everything is. The old system had relied on the fact that, you know, Jerry knew that this product was on the second shelf in the corner, and they could all tell each other, oh yeah, I put that product over there. Yeah. So everything was stored in their heads. And for 7,000 items, that's quite a lot of things to know kind of where they are. So we laid all the products out on the floor, and we kind of started trying to use the computer system. Very quickly became apparent that wasn't going to work. So we're like, okay, we'll try and use the old way. But the problem is nobody knew where any of these products were now. So instead of it taking maybe five minutes to get the stuff for an order, it was taking 45 minutes for a single order just to try and find where these products were. So it was dreadfully inefficient. We're already backed up 2, 3, 4 days at this point. Everybody goes away. All of the senior people, like the manager, went away on holiday. And I was kind of left alone, standing in this cold warehouse, like an hour out in the middle of Pudong, until sort of 2 a.m, trying to work out what the hell was going on. Meanwhile, customer orders are flooding in every day. And customers are getting annoyed that they're not received their order because we were supposed to ship it, and it became an absolute mess. I guess today, like these days, with my team and what we're doing, we're very much less keen to hit deadlines as we are to make sure when we do it, it's done right.
Yeah,
and that was a great lesson in how you should have done that. Like, we reached the point where I think we were 20,000 orders backed.
Oh my God.
Like, behind. And you think, imagine trying to shift that backlog. You've really got to be able to crank.
Yeah.
We were a huge China Post customer, shipping so many orders. And China Post sent in, like, their team to help solve this problem. And we even had, like, the boss of China Post came in herself and, like, helped pack some orders for our company as kind of a show of support.
I just picture you alone in the warehouse being like, and one, order two. Okay, let's see.
I mean, for me, it was insane because I barely spoke Chinese. And I was just stood there with these seven people who...
What was your role, like project manager? Like...
My role was, I mean, it was a startup company. Nobody really had that many, sort of that defined roles. I'd just been kind of brought in to help on this project. And it was... And the main guy who was running the project actually went away for a wedding at the same point. And it was... And so I remember leaving this warehouse like for several days in a row. The computer system started to get going, but it was incredibly slow. Instead of it taking 5 minutes to generate a list of orders, it was taking 50 minutes. And I had to manually... They weren't automatically. I had to manually, every 50 minutes, press a button to start the new one. And it would print out like 70 sheets of paper, which I'd then take through to... the team to go and pack these orders. And so I was staying there until 1, 2 a.m. And then I would jump in a cab, go hour and a half back to downtown Shanghai.
Yep.
Generally go to a bar or something like this, have a couple of drinks, get back in the cab and sleep on the way to the warehouse to start another day. And I was doing that for maybe 4 or 5 days at a time, and just like stressed out of my mind, like not knowing what I could do to affect the situation positively, other than keep printing these lists of orders. You don't want to give up, like, yeah, that was a real tough experience.
Wow, how long have you been in China, and have you been in Shanghai that entire time?
I've been in China about 9.5 years, and I've been in Shanghai probably. Most of that. I did a stint in Dalian for about 3 or 4 months.
Really?
I was in Hangzhou for about 3 months. In Dalian, I was part of China Accelerator, which is the startup incubator based in China, funded by a US venture capital firm. Yeah. And they had based themselves in Dalian. And it was great, actually, getting away from Shanghai for a few months and really focusing on a project. That was actually a website selling tailor-made dresses to women in the UK.
I want to ask you about that. There seems to be a lot of, when people come here and they see how easy it is to get things made in China, like dresses or paintings or anything, everyone always has that idea. It's like, oh my God, what if we made them here and then sold them back to America? We can make such a big thing. And then you realize like it's a lot harder, but you seem to not give up on those ideas. And
yeah. I try and sweat the detail on those things a lot. Yeah, I mean, that, I have had so many people since I ran kind of those businesses coming to me and saying, I've got this great idea. Like, and people always seem to think it seems so simple, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can just go and get
it. Also, they're the first people to think of it.
Yeah, they're, yeah.
Why doesn't this exist?
Right. And it's always still incredibly hard to convince them that it is not as easy as they think. Yeah. I had a friend recently from somewhere else in China, maybe Beijing, contacted me and said, "Oh, we've got this great idea for a business. Like, we're going to, you know, do tailor-made shirts online."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Okay, have you thought about this, 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 and this?" And it's like, "Oh, but that's just not going to be a problem."
Yeah.
And I was like, "I promise you it will be." Whether or not you...
I mean, my impression of it is that the production side of it doesn't cost that much. It's really the quality control that you're paying for, because those small details are often what gets left behind or, you know, neglected, and then you have 500 of these products, maybe only 200 of them are up to standard for what you would expect if you were selling them overseas, you know?
You know, there's actually another problem when it comes to tailor-made clothing, which maybe it is more specific to this, but is the expectations you set and whether or not you're able to deliver on them.
Yeah.
If you walk into a store and something doesn't quite fit you, like, you're kind of like, well, it wasn't made specifically for me. I'm kind of okay with it not quite fitting me. As soon as you're ordering something custom made for you, you're expecting that to be perfectly fitted for you. And
even if it's like a generic website, there's a lot of like tailor-made, but it still needs to be.
So you layer on top of that expectation, then people's understanding of how it fits them is very individual to them, like whether or not it's tight in certain places and loose in others. And measurements won't tell you that. Like, that's very much more their psychology of how they want this thing to make them look. You then put on top of that how inaccurate measuring people's bodies is. I remember talking to a startup in Germany who were trying to build a kind of a visual processing method of measuring you. So you stand in front of your webcam and it would kind of roughly...
In front of your webcam?
Yeah, so you'd stand in front of your webcam and you'd hold something of known size, which they used a CD because it's always they're always exactly the same size. And the webcam could then use that to calculate all the other parts of your body, as long as you... Yeah. And they, in part of their research phase, they got 5 tailors and sort of 20 volunteers, and they just had these tailors measure each of the volunteers like 3 or 4 times each, and on the same day. And each of those tailors had a high variance of measuring the same person multiple times in a day. And you think, you know, when you layer on top of the expectations, the psychology, the inaccuracies of even measuring a human body, and then you're going to get some tailor on the other side of the world to make some clothes for them, and you think that's going to fit?
Yeah.
Like, it's very little better than random chance whether or not it works.
I mean, we have great opportunity here to go to these markets to get tailor-made things cheap, compared to, like, in the US, cheap. But even if you're physically there and you go multiple times, it's still the chance it will fit that well is, like, not great. Like, you need to be on them. So I can't even imagine, like, trying to set it up, like, globally.
Also, in terms of technology, you know, they have those fit machines.
Yeah.
Even when you, like, step into it physically and it's, like, a 3D scan, like, you can't get a decent gauge on how those things will actually look on you.
And people's bodies change over quite short periods of time. I mean, you guys are boxing at the moment, right? Like, you will probably see quite rapidly over a period of weeks how different parts of your body change size, and that can have a huge impact on something that's supposed to be close fitting.
Yeah, I have several custom made suits that I wish I had accounted for all you can drink situations. They don't work as well for pie eating contests.
So why'd you get into specifically dresses?
Because
tell us about your dress company.
So that was, I love physical things, and I saw such an opportunity to create such a nice kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was where, as much as you might have a nice idea for something that you could explain to somebody and they say, "Yes, I want that," it doesn't necessarily mean you can deliver that thing they want. I loved the kind of the design, the aesthetic, the materials. We work mainly with like really nice silks that you can find here in China quite inexpensively. And there was a lot of people who were very interested in the concept.
Were you doing menswear as well?
We did do menswear. We had a really fun company. I started with a friend called Nehru, after the former Prime Minister of India. And it was basically an Indian-style jacket with a sort of a short collar, not a Western collar.
Nehru collars.
Nehru collars, right. and so Nehru, we had basically... This was kind of the final thing I did in sort of tailoring, and... We had just one design, and we did it in like 5 or 6 different colours. And we basically took some really nice wool, and we put silk linings in it, Chinese silk linings. So it's kind of a twist on this garment, and we did it in like 5 different sizes. So it was very much, we could just produce them and sell them in the UK. And that was really fun, and that, like, people loved them because they were quite unique and quite striking. But it was just a side project. Like, it was never anything more than fun. And the guy I was working with ended up being too busy to kind of carry on with it. And so we sort of let it have its day.
How many of them do you have in your closet now?
I don't actually have any left, I think.
Oh, really?
I lost my last one. I have one left. I had a really beautiful one, actually. We used to buy end-of-roll silk linings. Mm-hmm. So there would only be, like, 8 meters of that silk, and that was it. And I had this one that was like red with this beautiful like animal print lining inside
it. God.
And I left it somewhere, like in a bar or something like that, when I was drunk. And so I have almost none of them left. But yeah, that was super fun. And the guy who I did that with, Woody, great friend, and we always had such a laugh doing it. Like, there was no pressure in that. Like, neither of us did it to really make money. We just did it purely for fun, you know. And,
would you just sell those direct, or like wholesale?
We sold
them
back to the UK. We used to do mostly sort of large batches of them. He would do country shows in the UK, so he'd get a stand and like he'd wear one, and then we'd sort of sell them that way. We also did a couple of online sales through fab.com and things like this, where we shifted quite a lot. We shifted several hundred in a single go, and we sold e-commerce as well. Like, we'd have quite a few people order them from our website, and we'd promote them on Facebook. And we had this thing where we started writing poems, and we'd do a poem of the week on our Facebook page.
Oh my God.
That was my main contribution.
I figured it was.
But it was just a brand where you could have fun with it. I have a friend who in Shanghai is a great designer, and he recently started another project to do a similar thing, where the goal was just to have fun. Like, if you wanted to do anything, you didn't care whether or not it... fitted some consumer demographic or anything like that. It was like, do we like this? Yes, let's do it.
Yeah.
Which I kind of feels like the approach of this podcast as well, right?
Well, I was talking to a coworker of mine the other day about like side projects, and you know, we were both too busy to work on things, and we were talking about like an app. And I was like, oh, if you made an app and it made some money, enough money to run itself, so you're not paying out of pocket, is that like a success to you? He's like, absolutely not. I was like, see, I'm the opposite. Like, if I made something that could pay for itself, it's like success. That was fun.
Yeah. I think with so many of these projects, like Woody and I both probably lost a load of money with that company. Like, and I was just, we were just paying for it. Like, we did no accounts at all. We just paid for it out of our own pocket. I remember paying for the entire production for this, like several hundred jackets. And I don't think I ever saw anything come back in for that. But do I regret it at all? Not one bit. I had so much fun.
The fine art, if you come from like a fine art or creative background, it's more like you just wanted to make this. And yeah, if you sell something, that's great. Like,
yeah, just enjoying life.
As long as you don't cripple yourself like financially.
Yeah. I mean, I feel with the Elvis Fest that we worked on, definitely lost a bunch of money on that. But did make some back just from being able to give away t-shirts for Christmas presents that I didn't have to buy for literally everyone I know. It was great.
Yeah.
But this, you know, this comes to a kind of a broader philosophical point these days, in sort of, is like making money the only success outcome from a project? Absolutely not. Like, even for a company, should it be the only success outcome is making money? And I would definitely argue not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there have to be other kind of moral and experiential objectives to these things. Yeah, I guess these days, like, I try to achieve balance in my life between kind of work and the other stuff you do. And being quite an obsessive person, the only way I've found to achieve balance is to have multiple obsessions that kind of balance against each other.
So I want to ask you about starting a fly fishing brand. You don't seem like big fisher. one of your Chinese attempts?
Like, that was such a fun and interesting startup story. Basically, it was the first company I worked for in China. The founder of it invested in another project, which was this fly fishing technology. It was a great technology. Like, it did less harm to the fish, and it was, like, really quite... Like, it was awesome. Like, there were so many great things about the story. It was a really nice story around,
like... The lures, like the hooks?
So basically, a normal fly is like a bit of string tied onto a hook, right, to look like an insect.
Mm-hmm.
And this system separated those two things. It had a hook that was separate, and the fly was on a piece of rubber. And so the fish would eat the fly. The hook would stick in the outside of the fish's jaw, doing way less harm to the fish, because its jaw is basically just bone. And not it wouldn't go... Because the hook was not inside the fish's mouth, it couldn't, like, attack... hurt its gills or any of the soft parts of its mouth. And for fly fishing, where it's purely catch and release, they're not catching these fish to eat them. You're releasing a fish that's a much better chance of surviving. Yeah. And then there were, like, further commercial fishing implications for this technology as well, where it could have allowed... you know, Japanese do a lot of long line fishing, where they have a 70-mile line to try and catch tuna, right? And it would have allowed those the distance between the little lure and the hook determined what you would catch. So if that distance was set a certain distance, it would stop you catching dolphins and turtles. You would only catch the thing you were looking for because it swims at a certain velocity.
That's interesting.
So it was like a really interesting technology. And it was, and so my boss at the time invested in this technology, and we combined to make a company with the founder. And the plan was initially to launch it in fly fishing as kind of a consumer-facing thing, and then later on try and commercialize it in other ways. And the big problem we had was not understanding the fly fishing consumer.
And that was that's what I was going to say. Is like, I always think about that. Sorry to interrupt, but like you have like an idea for a technology, but you're not in that industry at all. It's like, is this worth?
I mean, the founder was in the industry, but I think unless you kind of have this awareness of how important it is to understand consumers, you can still be in an industry and just think you have a great idea.
Yeah.
But so we, fly fishing, very traditional industry, they're not looking for a revolutionary technology to come and help them. They're quite happy using stuff that's hundreds of years old.
Right. Is this technology also more expensive than...
Money was not a problem because fly fishermen are generally at the upper income end of the spectrum. It was change, right? Uh-huh. The last change that came to the fly fishing industry was the transition from bamboo to graphite fishing rods. And it took nearly 10 years for people to adopt this. Like, there was one company, I think, that was pushing this new graphite rods and almost went bankrupt because it was 10 years of trying to sell this thing and not really making much success.
Chinese fishing industry?
This was targeting the US. This was mostly targeting the US.
I was also going to say that you don't seem like the consumer who really gives a shit about the fish.
Like, the fly fisherman.
Yeah, like, oh, it'll help improve the health of the fish. And it's like,
I think maybe it wasn't their number one concern, but I think actually they were quite, like, generally people who had respect for the environment. Okay.
Makes sense.
And, but yeah, so the problem was, like, that business probably should have just been way slower. I think they invested $2 million and spent it within a year. And they should have really taken it really slow, built a deeper understanding of the consumers, and built a much more grassroots kind of brand.
Yeah.
And they just went really hard, too hard and too fast, spent all this money, and the whole thing kind of collapsed before it really got started.
Such a niche market.
But it was fascinating. We would try and like find different ways to sell the product to the consumers, and so we'd turn like this quite complicated system, which probably should cost several hundred dollars, into like a thing you could try for $12 or $13, like in a little kit that we could just mail to you. And we would buy email lists and send out major blasts, and we'd segment them into different types of email, and we'd have like really long form essay emails with no sales pitch, and then we'd have very aggressive emails that would be like, sell, buy this kit, you know, $29 free shipping. And it was so interesting, like, understanding, seeing which ones resonated in different ways with different sectors of the audience. And so I learned a huge amount about understanding your customer and the power of focus as well. Like, being able to really kind of target them in a very and just focus on doing one thing really well. But yeah, it was a great, great experience.
Alex, before you started in zoology, were you quite as environmentally conscious?
I think I've always been quite environmentally conscious. Like, the thing is, in the UK, as a child growing up in kind of a rural area, it wasn't really a problem because I wasn't living in a place where the environment felt like it was under threat. Like, it felt we were living quite harmoniously in our village, you know. It's only once I've really come to China and seeing how the destruction of the environment in this country that I've really become so entrenched as somebody who believes in sustainability. Yeah. And I cycle a lot in China as well, and so I get to go to quite rural areas, quite remote places. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, in some ways it's easy to accept that a city is a bit crappy and that it's having an environmental impact because it's, you feel like, well, it's a focused environmental urban centre and so it's going to destroy the environment here. But actually, when you see that that destruction of the environment has pervaded almost the entire country, you know, you go and cycle to these remote areas up in the hills and you see just the destruction and the wastelands, and that's the point where I really became incredibly sad. And so I've always been like quite, I love the natural environment, but then just seeing what's happened to it in this country has really made me sad.
That actually brings up a point I wanted to ask you about. Maybe you can get into better detail about, you've done presentations and focuses on bringing design and UX into the real world, into kind of everyday projects.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a passion that you want to get into more?
Absolutely. Like,
out of like tech and flat product into...
Yeah, I see so many times that, you know, humans' inability to kind of... Okay, so easiest thing to do. Kind of that's my sort of central premise. And so you cannot expect people to go out of their way to be sustainable. You cannot expect them to go out of their way to not pollute and to not consume. Mm-hmm. So we need to make the behaviours which are advantageous to the future of the planet the easiest things to do. And that's where I see design has a huge role. I think the talk you're talking about is about how the trash cans in Shanghai are like really badly designed, and so people don't do the recycle things because they just don't understand which side is recycling. Yeah. But that principle applies like in so many ways.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things. It's like people don't even realize how much thought goes into the design of products, and then even further is, you know, the real world applications of like labeling trash cans is such a basic thing, but it really affects the way. I mean, people not from China or Shanghai specifically aren't going to realize, but if you're ever in Tokyo, you can see like four or five, all the recycling bins have different colors, different lids for objects. And then China is like, you have one, they're next to each other. One has the recycling symbol and one has an anti-recycling symbol that no one's ever seen before.
Both are triangles.
Both are triangles of arrows. One's going the other way. And it's like, but it also looks like a tree. And it's like, I don't, what? These are the same logo.
The Japanese recycling bins, oftentimes they'll have only holes shaped for the things that are supposed to go in them. So even if you wanted to throw out your hamburger box into a can recycling bin, you couldn't because it's small and it's round.
But I've seen those in the U.S. as well, at least in New York, like in some train stations, the trash cans have started to have like a slit or a circle for like cups.
So the other thing you have in the West, which you don't have here in China, is you have a level of education that helps people understand why it is they should be recycling. Yeah. And so that's also a piece that's missing. And so the role of design in this country is even more important than it is in the West. Because in the West, you can rely on people to know that what they should be doing with their trash, or like, whether or not they do it. Here, you
just they'll learn from just looking at the trash can.
Yeah, but they went through school, you know, being told at school that why recycling was important.
No, I mean here, like, the design will educate them without them realizing, like, they're educating themselves.
I think it also feeds into just, like, that whole process where often... In my office building, I've noticed that all of the bins, regardless of the signage on them, even in a controlled environment like an office community, they all go into the same place. I mean, they're all being dumped in the same place. And I wonder if people took the time to segregate those their rubbish, that maybe the people taking it out would also be more conscious of like that going to different places.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, actually, I think although design has huge potential to help, we really need technology to solve these problems. Like, we need to mine our own waste. We need to have like completely automated recycling so that people don't even have to think about what they're doing. That the trash, however it's collected, is able to be separated and recycled to an incredible level. And we're not there yet with technology, and the energy it takes to do that is just too expensive at this point, but that's where we have to get to. Like, the number of people in Asia, they're just that you can't achieve behavioral change on that scale in the kind of time that we have to solve these problems, which I believe is a lot less than people think.
I guess we'll finish it up. If you could tell us your story, another entrepreneur story of starting your oil painting business here in China.
Oh my goodness, that was such a fun one. That was with a great friend who we've done a few different things together. And I met John when he'd had the original idea, and he didn't know how to build a website. He just saw that you could get these oil paintings painted by hand in Dafen, in this city in China. And he thought, awesome, we can sell this to Americans, basically. He's an American himself, of Chinese heritage. And he'd hired some guys on the internet from India to build a website. And it hadn't gone so well, to be honest. Classic experience of, you know, if you've never built a website before, you don't understand what makes it work, and so I can't blame him for that. And he was introduced to me, who was able to help him, and so I basically helped him get this website kind of up and running. And I actually said to him, John, we're going to have at least one sale on this site in the next week, because he was getting kind of nervous about how I was gutting all of the work his Indian team had done. And the Friday morning, the very last day of this week, he calls me in the morning, like 7 a.m. and he's like, Alex, we got a sale. And it was that point that we turned this from just me helping him out into us kind of working together and into our company. And so it wasn't the most noble of businesses. It was a reproductions website. Mm. And so we had the Mona Lisa, Mondrian, Picasso, whoever, you know, think of all the famous paintings. You could have them painted on our website. And our slogan on our homepage was, it was Van Gogh didn't paint it in your size, don't worry, we can.
And so did you have a preset selection? Or
we had a selection, yeah. Size was actually a bit of a challenge. Uh-huh. So we had this website. It was several thousand images on it. Mm-hmm. And you could order them, and we would have them painted and shipped to you. And it quite quickly turned out that a lot of these images had maybe, perhaps, been taken from another website, which was also trying to do the same thing. And this website had noticed that our images look remarkably similar to their images. I mean, they are out of copyright images, but still, it must be annoying when somebody just rips off what you're doing. I can totally understand
Rips off
that.
Your rip-off.
Rips off your rip-off, yeah. And so this website owner didn't take this lying down and started to cause us problems, contacted our hosting company and insisted that we had to be shut down. He would go on to live chat and start abusing like our staff through like the live chat. We did a couple of deals on group buying, was like a big trend at the same time. And we did a couple of group buying deals, and he would comment on these group buying deals saying, this is like a scam, like these guys can't be trusted. And we'd have these group buying companies calling us going, what is going on? Like, are you trying to pull a fast one on us? And there's so many different things wrapped up in this story. Like, it was just, the whole thing was ridiculous in some ways. We reached a point where John had other family commitments, and he came to me one day. We had a little tiny office that was basically a converted hotel room in some building near here. And we went and stood out on the balcony, and it was freezing. We're standing next to this air conditioning unit, and he sort of says to me, we can't, like, I can't continue to work on this business. Like, I need to, we were doing quite well at that time. We were almost breaking even, I think. I can't, like, I need to go and work with the family. And I said, well, I'm not going to continue doing this on my own. And so I said, we're going to have to, like, find a way to sell the company. And so there were a few other websites that we knew about, and we contacted all of them. We said, would you be interested in buying this company? And nobody was. Like, they were offering sort of almost no money at all. Like, it was not even worth transferring the domain for the amount they were offering. Because we had a whole a book of orders, you know, we had all these orders coming in. And then a last ditch attempt, he contacted this competitor who had been trying to shut us down. And within almost, I think, the email came back in reply within about 10 minutes saying, yes, I'll buy it for 10 times what anybody else was willing to pay. So we ended up selling this company to this guy that had been doing everything he could to screw us over and shut us down. So that was a...
Did you ever find out more about him? Like,
we didn't.
Were you, like putting him out of business? Or were you just...
You know, in life in general, I've always felt like it's best to spend your energy positively rather than trying to screw other people over. So we didn't work too hard to try and get back at him or anything like that. We just kind of didn't let him bother us too much or get under our skin. We did kind of try to find out, like, who he was, just to sort of see. And it was, like, a load of confusing aliases, different business addresses. Like, it was very shady. Like, he definitely was working hard.
How surprised were you when he was willing to...
Oh, I was shocked. Like, it was not my idea at all. I thought this guy would never buy our company. And he bought it and took all of the orders and all of the customers and the website and everything. And maybe he just wanted us out of the way. And this was a price he was willing to pay. But that was super fun. We learned a lot. We had, there were so many crazy people on our team. We had a Danish girl who had pretty strong dyslexia writing our social media posts in English on Facebook and Twitter. Our programmer was from Uzbekistan. And one day he said to me, Alex, my mother, she tell me I have to go home. She found a wife for me. And I was just like, wow.
Do what you gotta do.
And I said to him, I said, Zafar, I have just one question. Can I come to your wedding? And he was like, of course. And so, like, a couple of weeks later, I flew to Uzbekistan for his wedding. Like,
that's awesome.
Like, there were so many parts about this story that just, such a great time in my life. Like, I was as poor as anything. I could barely pay the rent.
Interesting adventure.
Like, I was working all of these different hours, multiple jobs, just to kind of stay afloat.
Yeah.
But I was definitely happy. I felt like I was doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you, John was probably running it, but you weren't running, you weren't working on this company full time?
Neither of us were full time, because it didn't really pay the bills.
Yeah.
Like, it was, but it was definitely our passion at the time. Yeah. We'd be there evenings and weekends. Mm-hmm. John would often sleep in the office. I'd get there in the morning and he'd be lying on the desk. Like, it was,
I wonder if, the guy who bought you out adopted any of your, like, search setups.
I didn't know, to be honest.
You had by artist.
Yeah,
size, by color.
Yes, yeah, you could. He did like he really liked some of the technology stuff we'd built, which his website didn't have. Yeah. I remember. So we definitely innovated. Sizing was a real problem. Like, I actually, John was away when we did one of our first group buying deals.
Yeah,
and I sized the painting wrong for this group buying deal. And it was like, I think I'd sized it in centimeters when it should have been in inches or something like this. And these paintings ended up being like two or three times more expensive to produce.
They were just gigantic.
And we were already doing this at a massive discount in order to do a group buying deal. And so it was just... Yeah, I think pretty sure we lost money on that. We had to create like a whole... page in an emergency where you could choose like extra framing options just so we could get more revenue out of these deals. Like, want a gold frame around your painting? And then we had to work out a way to like ship all of those frames to the US as well. Like, there were so many logistical issues.
Mm-hmm. I had a brief experience ordering reproduced paintings on Taobao of Elvis, like of these Elvis pieces that I really, really loved. And as like an artist myself, I mean, I took it so personally. Like, I would like argue over like the shading on the nose, and they'd be like, "No, we talked to the artist; they can't do that." And it's like, "Well, then you should send it to me and let me do it because I'm sure I could do it better." Which is one of the reasons that we have twin pieces of Elvis standing in front of Graceland. It's a copy
of... Two of the same painting.
Yeah, it's a copy of this portrait that hangs in the National Portrait Gallery of him. Yeah, and I was, like, very, very specific about it. And so one of them was just not up to standard, and the company ended up being so embarrassed about it. They were like, "Listen, we're going to give it to a more experienced painter." And so I was like, can I have both of them? They go, "No, we can keep it. We can sell it in our studio." And I was like, "No, for this price and how late it is, you're going to send me both of them." So now we have twin Elvises.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big problem we had. Like, when I priced this deal wrong, we tried to find a way to save money and give it to lower skilled artists. And, like, those other techniques where you could have it first inkjet printed onto the canvas and then basically just paint mm-hmm. over it. Which gives you kind of an effect of it being like an oil painting. Yeah. So
you can get the strokes right.
One of the things we looked at was using kind of cheaper, less experienced artists. And some of the paintings that came back were just horrendous. Like, people were sending photos of like really personal family events and moments and like engagement photos and dogs and things like this. And we, like, some of these people just look like cross-eyed and kind of in some way disfigured. Yeah. And you're just like, we can't
I'm sure a lot of these people have trained to like, reproduce a painting like Star Star Night, but then to make a painting of a photo is like a whole new ball game. These are not the people for that. Those are the higher tier people.
Yeah, so saving money was not
not the best move.
No.
Alright,
well, just to wrap up, I mean, Alex, you're quite an inquisitive person with these obsessive tendencies, so I'm curious, what are your obsessions this week?
My obsessions this week. One thing I've been super obsessed about this week is there's a new bike has been released by my favourite bike brand, Specialized, and I've set this thing as my desktop backdrop on my computer. Like, I can't stop looking at this thing. It's so beautiful, and it's a bike celebrating one of my favourite riders as well. And it's about for a race that is being run this weekend, happening this weekend. And so that's my obsession this week.
Are they going to bring it here to the Specialized store?
I'm trying to work out a way I can afford this thing. Like, I'm wondering what body part I can sell in order to buy this bike.
Can you buy it piece by piece on Lele?
Oh my god. I think it's about $4,000 or $5,000 just for the frame. Oh. And then probably looking at another $5,000 or $6,000 for the rest of the bits, the wheels and stuff. So I'm going to have to do something to own this bike.
Gonna eat a lot of cup noodles and basically. Yeah, basically. Yeah, basically.